We are so excited, you guys.
Oh, my God.
Because on this week's Coen Brothers Brothers, we're on episode 2, movie 2, chronologically. It is
1987's Raising Arizona.
Running down the street, grabbing Huggies. So Raising Arizona, which, man, we just covered Princess Bride not too long ago on Frame Rate, and we're like,
oh yeah,
there's certain movies you watch, and no matter how many times you've seen them, you go, this is goddamn delightful. Like, it is surprisingly delightful still on the 11th watch, and Raising Arizona is one of those movies.
I rewatched it for this. I hadn't watched it in a few years, and I was just telling you outside, I almost put it on immediately again rewatch it.
Yeah.
Because I was like, that at the ending, and I was like, oh, but that beginning, oh, that middle,
the opening, oh, that end. The opening. All right. So, as you probably guessed, this is the Coen Brothers Brothers, where we take a sophisticated look at the Coen Brothers, the greatest filmmakers of all time. And we do that by examining three spectra: diegesis, pedagogy, and howdy do that.
Howdy do that.
And we'll start with diegesis, which is everything that happens in the film. What does the movie look like, feel like? Mm. What's it about? So, Abe, you want to sort of recap the events of this for us?
So, Hi McDonough, played by Nicolas Cage, he's like a convenience store robber in Arizona. And he's a repeat offender. What's the word for it?
Recidivism.
Yep. And so,
a repeat offender.
It's the opening montage is him kind of like just talking about his situation over narration. But as we get to see, there's a love interest, Holly Hunter, who plays Edwina, aka Ed, as she takes the mugshots of him. And since he's a repeat offender, he keeps seeing her, keeps seeing her. And then,
right, she's a police officer.
She's a police officer, and it's. The shots are amazing because it's always just straight on. Like, she has her own mugshot.
This opening montage
that includes the camera
is A, one of the best parts of the movie. B, one of the best beginning parts of any movie ever. Like, it is a masterful montage. It's still,
again, voiceover.
One of the best montages that the Coens will ever do. And they do it a lot. So, like, I really feel like this is the genesis of a Coen trademark, which is the opening montage that with narration over it that just fucking blows your mind with charm and character and wit.
Yeah, and it's all in, like, it's narration, but it's also in the lines, because the narration will cut out and the song will come in and we'll keep hearing their talks. So, like, on the first time that he sees her, he's wearing that amazing... he always is wearing Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah. And I love that actually.
You're a desert flower.
Yeah, you certainly are. His introduction, the very first time we see him, is they say, H.I. McDonough, hi. And then he gets shoved into frame. So it's like literally,
hi.
And we're introducing the main character
and
now.
And people in the film call him H.I., but it's interchangeable with hi. So it's like, it's a name, but it's also Hi Junior.
Yeah, like, and the frame he gets shoved into is the ruler, you know, the mugshot ruler that they have.
Sizing him up.
But it's Dutched. I love that.
Yeah.
Like, so our opening image of this one of the main protagonists is, like, he's in this skewed world and he can't get through. He can't get right.
She's always upright. Everything's, like, very centered and flat, meaning, like, you look at just those two people. Everything else is window dressing. So his askew world is kind of put into correction as soon as he meets Ed.
Right.
And then from there, he's got a goal. And so anyway, after continued visits and I think he's been in jail. Like, I tried to count it because they were flipping pages, but I saw that, like, some of them were double. So it's at least over 8 times.
Yeah,
he has been in jail. So no 3 strikes law here. But he finds out that she's always stoic, always the same. Just like, she's just doing her job, and, you know, starts to warm up to him a little bit. But then what really happens is that he finds out that Ed's fiance has left her.
Right.
And she's
and he flips
sobbing.
Out.
He's
he
like, goes, "What's wrong?"
Yeah.
And he flips out. He's like, "You tell him, McDonough's gonna come find him.
Like, if you need to find, if he has a problem with that, I'll be in cell block C of Wing D of the prison for men in Tempe, Arizona."
In Tempe, Arizona.
And I love in that montage, also has one of just the funniest exchanges of dialogue I've ever experienced.
Which one?
The shot where he is underneath his bunkmate. And it's like this static shot of one bunk, two bunk. And the guy is closer to camera because we're looking down. It's like, when there was no pig, we ate fowl. And when there was no fowl, we ate sand. You ate what? We ate sand. You ate sand? That's right.
It's just such a good, like, all right, these guys had a conversation about sand. That's what that was. You ate sand? That's weird. Yeah, sand. Just the,
it hits like every prison trope in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That you're,
To the machine shop where Emmett Walsh is talking about his stories with Bill of different kinds. Bill Watson.
Who played the main antagonist in Blood Simple, and Emmett Walsh. Yeah. Comes back for a minor role in this where he's just like his buddy at the machine shop he works at when he's trying to like get his life together. And
we never see High's face in this whole sequence. Anytime we're with this guy, which is like twice, it's on High's back and it's just shots of Walsh.
Yeah. Incidentally, on High's back is a patch that identifies that the plant they're working at is Hudsucker Industries.
Oh,
which
nice.
Is amazing. Yeah.
Nice. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's fucking great. Why would they do that? Oh, I know. Because Hudsucker's Acme and it's a Looney Tune.
And Hudsucker, they had written at this time. In fact, after Blood Simple, the Coens wanted Hudsucker to be their next film.
Right.
After they scripted it out, two things happened. They realized it was way more expensive to make than they were going to raise at this point
in
their careers.
So they did Miller's Crossing. So
they did several in between.
And then Barton Fink.
Yeah. And then also, they often write roles for one particular actor, and they only wanted Paul Newman for the role in Hudsucker.
Right.
And Paul Newman said no. So he literally just waited until he said yes, which took many years.
Because they're like, I guess we got to get better to get Cool Hand Luke.
Right. So instead, they made Raising Arizona, which to hear them tell it is a sellout movie in the sense that they wanted to show that after Blood Simple, they weren't just going to be all doom and gloom intensity. They didn't want to get pigeonholed into only making crime noirs.
Yeah.
So they made this zany, balls to the wall Looney Tunes comedy.
Which might be the best version in that genre, I guess.
Yeah.
That has ever been penned. It's just so delightful.
Yeah.
Having conversations with the warden and
the parole board.
The parole board, yeah.
Yeah. With it embedded in the montage, there's this repeated hilarious thing with the parole board.
Yeah.
Where every time they decide to let him out on parole, the head parole guy goes, okay then. And then it cuts them committing another crime and getting arrested.
And they're like, are you just telling us what you want to hear?
Yeah,
well, I'm telling you the truth.
The final beat of it, I wrote down because it's one of the best parts. You know what you are, High? You're a recidivist. Not a nice name, is it, boy? No, sir, that's one bonehead name, but that ain't me no more. Don't just tell us what we want to hear. No, sir, no way. Because we just want to hear the truth. Well, then I guess I am telling you what you want to hear. Boy, didn't I just tell you not to do that? I'm sorry, sir. Okay, then.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
It's such a good sequence. It's perfectly crafted. Okay. So immediately.
He gets paroled.
He gets literally put in the clothes on they had on his back, walks right in. He's now combed his hair. He's no longer Woody Woodpecker. And he walks right up to her and says that they're going to get married, proposes to her and the two get married and they have a very short sequence of what's the lines? It's like
the salad days,
I do,
as they
no,
say.
No. The oh. I do. And then of course, or
well,
something.
No. The priest says, okay, then.
Okay.
It's
then.
The last
right,
beat of the
right.
Okay. Then they just go, the wedding's great. Cause they do the entire wedding in four shots.
Mm.
There's just his face looking up saying, I do. Her face looking up saying, you betcha.
You
or
betcha.
Something.
That's it.
And then the shot of the priest saying, okay then. And then a high, wide, and stupid shot of the entire party, which you realize on the bride's side, it's all cops in uniform.
Yeah.
And on the groom's side, it's literally all guys who look exactly like Nick Cage for some reason.
Well, it's because they're all the scufflaws.
Right, but apparently scufflaws all wear identical Hawaiian shirts in this universe.
Exactly, because that convenience store robbery.
Right, and everyone just cheers, and now you know they're married.
Yeah, it's unlikely marriage, but here we are. So, they move into a desert mobile home, the salad days, as they say. And High gets a job in a machine shop, which later comes into play because he loses his job. But they want to have children, so they keep trying. But we figure out that she's infertile.
As he says in the montage, another line I highlighted, the doctor explained to us that her insides was a rocky place where my seed could find no purchase. Which I also got to say right off the bat, this echoes way more than I remembered of Oh Brother, or foreshadows it, I suppose. I really feel like Nick Cage's dialect evolves into the George Clooney dialect in Oh Brother in a way. Yeah. And you even end up with him, John Goodman, and then the really dumb guy, which is the same as the Oh Brother crew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they just kind of talk like Oh Brother, but less dated.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, in fact, the accent isn't even like it's not an Arizona accent.
No, Arizonans called it out at the time for being like, they're like, what are you trying to present? Because
are they hicks? Or
they all have really deep southern accents, which is not accurate.
And it's not
Arizona.
A real like southern accent, because it's also got that slow drawl.
It's like a Georgia or Alabama accent.
Yeah, it's like a simpleton.
There's no one with like a Spanish accent, which would be more true in Arizona.
Right, right.
And they also said, you know, that dialect, no one in the world talks like that. And I think that's what's amazing is the Coen said, oh, we know. This takes place in like a cartoon universe where the dialect is what we made it, because it's like imagine it's a fantasy novel. The elves talk like this because that's what the effect we wanted. And we don't care that it's totally inaccurate to what Arizona's
like. It's the tone that we wanted to do.
Right.
And that's why they did it.
And they've actually said the dialect is based on how someone would talk if they repeatedly read only the Bible and supermarket tabloids. And after reading that in an interview, I'm like, yeah, that tracks. He's like, he combines the highfalutin structure of biblical messages with just hick tabloid stuff. It's great.
Yeah. So after they figure out that she can't have children, she spirals into a kind of depression, which is a great sequence because I love how she arrives by car and then like he has this. It's basically still his monologue. This whole fucking thing is like it feels like a continuous monologue.
We're still in the opening sequence. Yeah.
Before we get introduced to the Arizona Quince, but So they try to adopt, and because of his record, can't do it. Nothing. I don't really have anything to add to that.
He said, we were still more in love than ever, but I premonished no return of the salad days.
Because she stops even doing the housekeeping, as he says.
Right.
So it's then just shot of Holly Hunter just sitting on a bed, like absolutely lethargic, and there's just clothes
like a hoarder
thrown
house.
Around.
Right.
Yeah, it's. But it's still played to this really happy tune, which is just like a crazy, like they want to tell you that in this world, people can be unhappy and you can still be like everything is still like kind of a fantasy. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things they were dinged by in criticism. There's like, you're not really saying anything if you're not like treating the fact that, a family coming to terms with like,
infertility.
That's a real thing. And they were like, oh, yeah, it's, but I mean,
but this is a cartoon version of it.
Yeah, it's a cartoon.
Man, fuck those people. And I say that with a heavy heart because Roger Ebert gave this a thumbs down, and it's really sad.
Yeah. They didn't get it, I don't think.
I'd like to think he would have changed his mind in retrospect. But then, exactly at the 10 minute mark, I made a note. The Arizona Quince are first mentioned, which is the inciting incident.
After the first sequence, 10 minutes.
This is
10 to 12 minutes.
This is, if you don't know, 10 minutes in is exactly where like a cookie cutter movie places the inciting incident.
Right.
So I think the Coens are still very much in the point in their career where they're like, let's not fuck with the formula. Let's just do the best formula ever.
Right. And so Holly Hunter's character, Ed, she basically she stopped going to work, so she's no longer
a cop. Yeah.
So she decides to turn to crime, and they're like, how could God give one family so much and everyone else so little?
And in an interview, the father, Nathan Arizona, says, it's more than we can handle. And she sort of fixates on that and is like, see, they said it's more than they can handle.
So
we'd be helping them out.
One.
They're going to steal one baby.
And it might be.
Oh, but Quince. In case, because it's also a fruit, in case that's not clear, quintuplets.
Yeah.
So a set of quintuplets are born to this rich family in Arizona.
Yeah.
Nathan Arizona.
Who sells furniture that's unpainted.
Unpainted Arizona, the state's Raising largest a, warehouse.
Yeah, no, of, sorry. Yeah. It's Unpainted Arizona is the name of it, right? And so then starts one of my favorite sequences in the movie. God, I'm going to just repeat that every single time. Mm-hmm. That kind of propels the story forward because now we actually get their dialogue about what... how they're going to do it. And they like show up and he, Nick Cage, we cut right into the kids,
in their nursery,
which is fantastically shot. Everything is like at baby level or straight on looking up and down at babies. It's like this crazy, I don't even know what to call it. It's like, it's like just a myriad of different tones that they hodgepodge together.
It feels like, like the little cartoon that begins Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
It's like a separate, like almost that old school thing where you take a break and you're just like, here's an episode of Baby's Day Out where there's wacky baby jokes where the babies are in danger and then they narrowly are saved.
And there's too many babies.
Right.
And they all are going towards places. They have a small digression where Arizona family is, or at least Florence, Arizona,
and Nathan Arizona.
Are keep hearing they're like, what does he say? They're restless.
Sounds like Nathan's restless. Yeah. Nathan.
And finally, she goes up, and there's a small bit of drama of like, he has to put all these babies back. He does it, but we don't see him doing it.
Blah blah blah.
High goes back down.
He steals a baby.
He doesn't. Yeah, but I want to talk about like when he comes back to Holly Hunter.
Yeah.
And he's just like, "There, you should have seen him. They're on me. It was all these like, I couldn't take one. I couldn't find the right one."
Oh, that's
and
right.
And she demands you do not return here without a baby.
Right. I love the shot. There's one shot that's a tracking right to left shot where you see all five babies each engaged in a different activity. And as the shot ends, he picks up the fifth baby. That must have been annoying to get, but a great shot.
15 babies played the Arizona quintuplets.
And did you read, you know Antichrist, right? Lars von Trier?
Yeah.
Well, one of the, actually, I won't spoil it in case people haven't seen it. There's spoilers to Coen shit, but we shouldn't spoil Collateral movies in this.
Yeah, probably not.
But, so I won't tell you why I mentioned Antichrist, but I will say, did you know one of the babies was fired because they learned to walk and they would start...
In Raising Arizona.
Right. During the filming of Raising Arizona, one of the 15 babies who turned out to be one of the lead babies started walking and liked walking and would walk in, like stand up and walk in shots. And they fired that baby when they found out that the mom was trying to keep it from walking by putting its shoes on the wrong feet so that it was in pain all the time.
That's some
fucking stage moms,
that's
dude.
That's why... studio teachers exist.
Right. And the Coens found out and they're like, oh, you're fired. Take your baby home and don't come back.
So there's a rule in Hollywood, if you don't know what a studio teacher is, which is essentially a third party member who is usually like they're credentialed as a teacher, but they're there to protect a series of different things that could happen. And it kind of started with the Twilight Zone movie because like kids died and stuff like that. And it created like a whole sequence of laws of how you treat children and like what brackets, if they're under 18 months, if they're older than 2, if they're younger than 7, you have all these rules you have to follow, including how, like how long they're there and all that stuff, because
under lights, stage the lights are hot.
Parents often want their children to be like the best one. So they often will go very, very far in order to maintain a job and be like the star baby, to the point of like hurting their own children.
Right.
And a studio
famously,
person,
in The Exorcist, people asked Selma Blair's mom often, like, is that it? Selma Blair?
I don't think so.
Linda Blair.
Linda Blair.
People asked Linda Blair's mom often,
no, I don't know,
is this what you like? Didn't it feel weird? Didn't it bother you? Because I don't, if you haven't seen The Exorcist, there she says, like, your mom sucks cocks in hell and stabs herself in the vagina and makes her mom eat the blood from her own
vagina.
But
they reversed it and she learned it phonetically, right?
I don't know. My point is,
that's how they did
this. This is like a 15-year-old girl. Okay, that's cool. But people often ask the mom, like, was that weird for you? And no, like, the mom lobbied hard for her daughter to be this.
To be the
and it
demon
ended up
character,
ruining
yeah.
Linda Blair's life. It's just... stage moms are so weird to me. It's this weird subculture.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. So yeah, she steals a baby.
He steals a baby.
He steals a baby. They steal a baby. Baby's there's now Nathan Jr.'s in the car. They
that's
think.
The one. Yeah, and there's some great lines here. He says, "Here's the instructions," and throws Dr. Spock's baby book in the car,
which is like all over the film. I think multiple people take it. You know, John Goodman takes it because it's their baby now too. Later in the film, like it just keeps coming up.
And then it's such a human, funny foible. He wants like praise for the thing he just did.
Yeah,
he goes like, "He's a damn good baby. I think I got the best one. And she's like, "Well, all babies are beautiful." And he's like, "This one's damn good though."
And it's probably my favorite like little piece of performances in that car, where Holly Hunter immediately, like drop of a pin, is just like, "I love him so much."
It's everyone loves that delivery. It is hilarious. And I realized this time that I think it shows masterful editing too, because I can't prove this, but I feel like that was scripted for her to say once, and they used two takes.
Yeah,
because she
it's
does
like
it
literally the same way.
And the funniest aspect of it is it cuts back to him going, "I know, honey, and I know, honey, I know," is the line. But instead it goes, "I love him so much." Cut back to him and he goes, "I know, honey." Cut back to her and she says exactly the same.
I love him so much.
And he says, "I know." Yeah. I feel like when they were editing, they were like, "Yeah, keep it rolling."
Yeah, that might be right. Because you do that as an editor. You just think of like, oh, you just.
And then she is like, around. "Is this okay, though, that we stole the baby? Is this morally wrong?" And he says, "Listen, honey, there's what's right and there's what's right, and never the twain shall meet."
Yeah.
It's just like, what the fuck does that mean?
So they return home. "Welcome home, son," is a banner that they literally have. And when they return home that's just the sequence where they're just talking about
how they're going to raise the baby, right?
And yeah.
She's realizing.
They don't know anything. They realize.
They don't know much, but she has big ambitions and is already telling him how he's going to have to change and change his life. He's like, "You're father now. You got to do this. We're going to have to get insurance and shit."
Meanwhile, we have Gail and is it Evel?
Evel.
Gail and Evel. Jeannie, John Goodman and William Forsythe.
Snotes. They're the Snotes brothers.
The Snotes, which is like these two fat guys who are friends, who are bank robbers.
Who are friends of Nick's in prison.
And not convenience store robbers. And they were in prison. They broke out. And the
actually, they were convenience store robbers because they're
just up in the game list.
This is the first bank ever they want to be in. We want to make some of ourselves.
I thought it was because he's like, "Now we know you pride yourself on being a convenience store robber."
Yeah, either way.
John Goodman literally comes out of the muck like a swamp, which is Shawshank Redemption.
I was going to say, it's more effective to me than the Shawshank sequence.
Just because he's screaming the whole time.
And it predates it. Yeah, it's better.
He lifts up his brother by the leg.
Which functions as a joke. Like, it's crazy how without dialogue they can subvert your expectations. The only thing you... immediately your brain clicks is, "Oh, he's gonna pull someone out by the hand." So they undermine that assumption and it's his foot.
Right.
It's so
which
good.
Is just a Chuck Jones Roadrunner thing.
But basically what's literally happening is two prisoners have dug out. But it's like it's this delightfully confusing thing where you're just seeing John Goodman come out of the mud like he's being born from the earth and scream the whole time.
My favorite part is that as soon as his brother arrives, of course, when his head is revealed, he's screaming in perfect unison with his brother, as like, if he was down there screaming.
You just couldn't hear him because his mouth was covered with mud.
Yeah, exactly. And I love there's one shot. The last shot of the thing is that as he's screaming, he's had his two hands on both of his feet. The last shot is, and I wonder if it was intentional or John Goodman was just because obviously to lift someone out of the muck, there's a lot of safety concerns.
Right.
Like they're not faking that water and that mud. So someone's down there and it's like a platform that they had that they probably had, you know, either they built like something under it and just filled it with mud.
So he could breathe, right?
Yeah, so he can breathe. And also there's an apparatus because John Goodman can't lift a man by his feet.
Right, he's super strong.
With such ease. And as like a joke at the very end, the last shot, and if you blink, you miss it, he puts his other hand down. So not only is he strong enough to do that,
he can
he's
do
strong
it
enough that he can hold up his brother upside down.
By one ankle. While he's screaming at the heavens.
And they're both just screaming at the heavens.
And you're like,
wait.
Who are these people?
Yeah.
And then they show up.
They show up
at the trailer park.
Yeah, and I love the touch of like talk about things to note on other films that they do. They're not a Dapper Dan man, but no. They both love to put
pomade. I don't think it's fop either, but
it's
not
fop.
Like, they immediately
go something else.
Which is
but
important
they love,
later.
Like, Coen brothers love the idea of someone slicking their hair back.
Yeah, greasers.
Greasers.
Yeah, yeah, so they go, they stop off at a gas station bathroom and put pomade in their filthy hair, and then yeah. They go to find Nick Cage. I also wanted to say, since you mentioned the banner, did it strike you on this viewing, did it remind you at all of Arrested Development?
Yeah, a little bit. Now that you mention it, like, it didn't strike me, but
the jubilant tone and some elements of the farcical confusion,
the magical world they live in,
and just the welcome home, son banner, and they were like, I don't know, there was just stuff that really, like the biker is like ice, and their Arrested Development overlap.
Yeah, that's very strange.
The other thing is, I don't know if Wes Anderson, I mean, he must have seen it. It's a famous, famous film, and he's a man of
but
film.
But working in pastel colors and the framing.
I was like, wow, I give Wes Anderson way too much credit. This does 80% of the Wes Anderson shots, and this is way before he
that
even was of adult age.
Exactly right.
You agree? Yeah.
No, I've actually long... I liked Wes Anderson as a filmmaker, especially Royal Tenenbaums where it talks about dysfunction. But
he's
I think
a great writer,
I
too.
I constantly think that even though he's... very good at what he does, and who am I? I'm you know, starting my directorial career, really.
Right.
And this guy's accomplished so much.
And he writes the
script. He can write really
good
stuff.
Good,
Bottle Rocket's good script, all that stuff. But a lot of people, and now he's kind of like dipped into it because he realizes it's exactly what like people liked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what like Zach Braff came on and said, like, I'm going to do my own Wes Anderson thing. It's called Garden State.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, where it's just like, at a certain point, it's framing the same way always, keeping the shots really flat and like dollhouse looking, like a cut like a
cross section.
And then let's just pick the coolest art director and have them show me floral prints all day.
And the Coens art direction team is unstoppable.
Yeah.
Every costume is so detailed. I love Florence, Arizona has a brooch at her neck with a bas relief of kids running around a maypole. I'm like, where the fuck did you find that costume?
Just how perfectly all of High's like all of his Hawaiian shirts are both completely different and all absolutely
identical.
The same, which I know is true about Hawaiian shirts, but like the color tones, like they like take turns. It's like either teal blue or it's like orange, like gaudy orange.
Yeah.
And somehow they all have the same colors.
Same pattern. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing. It's just the choices that they did for that shit are I like,
and you can already tell in this movie, I think more than Blood Simple, 'cause it was so such a small cast, although Dan Hedaya is very interesting looking. In Raising Arizona, you start to see another thing that will become a Coen trademark. They love casting, when they cast extras who they aren't going to lean on hard for a lot of acting talent, they're like, give me the weirdest looking guy you got.
Yeah.
They love people with interesting faces.
He's a suitor.
And that, I think, is part and parcel of the art direction.
Yeah. But I just one last bit, if
sure,
just because I think it's interesting, and we'll probably not necessarily do a Wes Anderson film on this podcast. If you guys look for, it's probably on YouTube, there was like early 2000s American Express ad with Wes Anderson that to me sums up, and he's in it. It's like the whole point is like, it like follows him in on a set.
On set, I've seen the ad. Yeah.
So you've seen it, and it's exactly what I think the version of like America's narrative of who Wes Anderson is and what he doubled down on and said, that's what I'm
I will
good
be
at.
That if that's what you
because
want.
Because it's a series of people just bringing him a thing and saying, what do you want? As he's giving this American Express like monologue, they're just like, which floral print do you want? And he just points at it and he's just a Rube Goldberg machine of dispensing
of selecting twee things.
Yeah. And it's all twee and it's all like, and I'm just like, how, why did you like, clearly you're, cause if I like, if you were to, whatever narrative we have of Christopher Nolan, do you think he enjoys that there's a narrative about, I know you don't enjoy that. Like people think that you are just Michael Swaim from Agents of Crack.
All
you know?
Artists think that they're bigger than whatever thing they do. Yeah.
And he,
and some are
decided,
right and some are wrong.
He decided not to. And maybe there's something wise about that. But anyway, it's like the perfect like thesis for what,
but
he
watching
is.
Raising Arizona, you realize the Coens just like, dropped down, demolished Wes Anderson style film and moved on to something totally different the next day.
Yeah, they just put on a different hat.
And that's truly why they're because Spielberg, I think you could, obviously many people would say, but Spielberg's the best filmmaker of all time. Yes, for consistent, transparent filmmaking, but the Coens have style and have demonstrated a wide array of tones and style in every movie. It's crazy to me, the filmography that they have.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted to be going through it with you. So the escaped criminals show up at the trailer park.
So the Snouts basically are this undesirable element that Holly Hunter does not want there.
Bad influence.
She tries to put her foot down, but in a very misogynistic way. John Goodman's like, who wears the pants in this family? That doesn't get to high. But what they have done is they've gotten into his brain where he's starting to fall back to his... Like, with all these pressures that are on him, he's starting to think about crime. In fact, he drives around and drives towards convenience stores that he is in. Aren't even on the way home.
And of course, because he's realizing that the baby needs a lot more money than he initially thought.
Yeah.
He didn't know about things like insurance and whatnot, and now he needs them. Yeah.
Well, that stuff doubles down later.
I know, we'll get there. But he is already worried about money. That's why the impulse to rob stores.
Yeah, so he decides to return to his felonious ways, which is Leonard Small is a reference to...
Yes, of Mice Lenny and Men. Lenny Small.
Oh, really?
Who is, of course, if you're not familiar with Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, it's a very straightforward reference. He's just a big, dumb animal type of guy.
My friends call me Lenny.
But I don't have any friends. Yeah. So this character is Leonard Smalls, who's described as like an apocalyptic hell biker.
So yeah, he's basically, which is like gotta be, it's like a Mad Max reference. And here's, oh shit, I got to hold on to pedagogy for that.
But yeah, so the cops are proving ineffectual, and Nathan Arizona is approached by Leonard Smalls, who is a bounty hunter.
Yeah, because next what happens is the problems get worse, because High Supervisor Glenn, played by Sam McMurray.
The cops are there. We have the scene where it proves that the cops can't get the job done, and he says... I just need a goddamn person who knows the difference between a lead and a hole in the ground. Smash cut to the hole in the ground at the prison.
Yeah.
So we also know the cops are beginning to close in on, like, they will eventually find them at High's place.
Right.
And that will, of course, ruin their lives.
And Nathan Arizona is pissed off because
But three times High has dreams that are visions.
Yeah.
And this night, he dreams that, you know, there's a lot of danger in their lives. Things are getting really tough. And it's manifested by this hell biker that he dreams up,
so,
who turns out to be real.
Which adds insult to injury. So he's got this, you know, he's got the brothers who are like making him think of crime. He's got all this pressure from
they want
the
to
baby,
rob a bank.
And he's got this fear, which is kind of like prophecy in his dreams, that there's someone coming to get him, and he has to, because of the crime they committed, is going to have some kind of justice like put upon him.
And just so you know what Leonard Smalls is like, he has one of the best intros ever in the dream. He... has a tattoo on his arm that says "Mama didn't love me,"
which identically is shown later. Yeah. That's actually his tattoo. Like High for some reason dreamt his tattoo, and
he has tiny bronzed baby booties as a trophy on his belt, as if he murdered a baby. I guess.
Yeah. Also, in that dream sequence, he especially hates
little sweet things.
So he throws a grenade at a bunny, and he shoots and explodes a lizard.
And then he drives by a flower, which causes it to burst into flames.
It's amazing.
Exactly a Tex Avery sequence of events.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And it's perfectly Roadrunner.
Fun fact, to get the lizard shot, this is still before complicated CG, you guys, they had a tiny lizard harness. It's so cute.
Whipped him.
And it was someone's job to yank the lizard out of frame right before the squib exploded. Yeah. And the lizard lived. The lizard, because... We're pretty strict with animal safety on set.
Not at this time. For them.
No,
in
okay.
fact, they got dinged later in Barton Fink.
For the mosquito shot.
For the mosquito shot, which I thought was interesting because there's a fly shot. Yeah.
There's a shot in this where Leonard Smalls grabs a fly out of the air.
He's like, this place is air climate controlled. And so he doesn't believe there's a fly in there.
In the
but it means, I think, signifying that Smalls brings
death. Superhuman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering how they got that shot of the fly, because it obviously hurt the fly.
They might have killed the fly.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the lizard they didn't kill. There was a little tiny lizard harness.
Little baby lizard harness. And a little mouse that rides them.
Right. So, yeah, their friends from work come over, which are a couple, Glenn and Dot. Glenn is his supervisor at the sheet metal
plant.
They
have so many terrible children.
Yeah, that's true. They have like eight terrible kids.
Just throws things on everyone. Just throws rocks indoors, beats him. The opening shot is of the wide of all the kids, and High is just standing near the refrigerator, and there's just a kid with a
crayon.
No, well, there's a kid, yeah, fart.
Well, I'm talking about Buford. What's yours?
Yeah. Well, the opening shot is there's just a kid who just had, I think it's like a plastic bat. He's just beating the shit out of High.
That's true.
His legs. Yeah. And it's just like they're having a conversation, and High is just standing there like, well, I can't stop this.
Right.
What it does is this is his worst fear.
Is that the future that will become unmanageable and crazy. Yeah, let's talk about some of the highlight kids. There's a little filthy girl with an eye patch, like she's injured one eye, with Pop-Tarts crammed in all the pockets of her overalls.
Yeah.
There's a kid named Buford who just writes the word fart in all caps on their wall with crayons. And then I love Buford write farts on the wall, and Glenn's response is, look at that. He already knows his ABCs. Hit the deck, boy. And he throws a handful of Skittles at him. So the kid has to like duck out of the way.
Of course, some of them hit him. It's just
hit
like
the deck,
he
boy.
Thinks that's I think that's Glenn thinking he's interacting with his children, like playing catch
with them. Yeah.
You know, like it's just that, well, I'm proud of my kid. That makes me think that I should interact with my kids. I love kids. Here's how you play with kids. You throw things at them. Yeah. Ah, that's great. Anyway, Hi, what were you saying?
Right. And Glenn is masterfully played by Sam McMurray, who is a great character actor and cartoon voice actor who's been in literally a million things. Like, I can't. Francis McDormand is Dot. And
there's a cool fact about this sequence that I want to talk about with her, which I didn't know before reading about it or researching into it. But there's a conversation with Ed and Dot that they're having outside, where Dot is just harping on, does he have his...
Does he have insurance? Does he needs his tet shot. He needs his dip tet.
And he needs this and needs this and needs this and stuff like that. At the beginning of that sequence, Frances McDormand suddenly shouts off camera she invented a complete another child that you wouldn't have seen.
And you know what I realized? She
doesn't
invented,
call him by name.
It's Will Ferrell's Get Off the Dang Shed.
Bit. Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly that. Yeah. And she shouts it, and you can actually see it in the take because you don't not use
You're
that.
Looking at her, yeah.
Yeah, you're looking at her. You don't...
But Holly Hunter...
Holly Hunter is just hiding a laugh because she was
breaks.
Like so startled by essentially what Frances McDormand says, like, at her chat, like, get your... what is it? Take your sister's diaper off his head and
put it back on her. Yeah.
And so it's just this random ad lib, and it's just such a good ad lib. The idea that not only are there two other children that you don't even know them by name, she's not yelling anyone's name. They could already exist, but it's just, there's so many other kids. But when they're shooting the scene, there's no kid there.
And Frances McDormand may be the only person to get an ad lib through the Coen Brothers machine. Like,
I
wonder.
I think Totoro got squeaked by with a few, but yeah.
Oh, actually, the famous Miller's Totoro scene is ad libbed, I think.
Yeah,
they
told
him to ad lib that.
There's sometimes they use it, but,
Glenn,
she kills it. Like, the idea
she
of putting a diaper on his head.
It's fine. It's fine.
It's fucking amazing.
I like Glenn. How many Pollocks does it take to screw in a light bulb? I don't know, one? No, three. Wait. No, I told it wrong. How come it takes three Pollocks to screw in a light bulb? I don't know.
Because they're so darn stupid. Yeah, it's just
And he goes, Nick Cage doesn't laugh, and he goes, see, that's why they call it a way homer. You only get it on the way home. And then Nick Cage says, I am home.
And it's also a payoff for later for when we find out exactly what happened. Like, because he's never convinced any police officers that this crime went down because every
time... Well, before the horse. They don't know about the crime yet, but they will soon.
Well, they know about the crime.
Yeah, we'll get there. No, but Dot and Glenn don't, I'm saying.
But he tells a Pollock joke to a police officer. And
we'll see
just,
that when it happens.
I don't want to. I want to see it now.
Oh, also, he has a good off-camera yell that I probably wasn't ad-libbed, but all the kids' names are like traditional hick names. And then one time... Glenn just yells off camera, mind you don't cut yourself, Mordecai.
Mordecai.
One which, of their kids is named Mordecai.
Because because in the earlier scene, Dot is telling Ed that you should name, what's his name? And she was like, we're thinking High Junior. She's like, you should choose one from, you know, like a name from the Bible.
Which is Mordecai. Yeah.
So in other words, their children are these weird hick names or their Bible names because Dot got to name that one.
Yeah.
Because that's just what they are. Just this... whirlwind of a family.
So then it brings up, and this is what everything starts sliding out of control, for our main character, because he's now acting back. He's just been receiving information this whole movie, basically. And the drama starts because Glenn mentions that we should, swing. We swing.
They're on a walk, just Glenn and he confides in him. You know, it is tough being a father. I'm pretty stressed out. And he goes, you know, it's good for de-stressing. Why don't we all fuck each other?
Yeah, exactly.
And
he punches him.
He punches him super far,
which is another nod to like a cartoon.
Cartoon logic, yeah.
Just like the idea of like any time Wile E. Coyote gets hit, he gets hit
a million feet. Right.
So when Haya hits him and then it's that upshot angle at high to reveal that he must have punched him 30 feet?
Sure. Feet? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's his boss, remember? So this is tantamount to like, he runs off with a bloody nose and says, Dot, let's go. And then she's like, you know, you're going to lose your job. And he's like, yeah, I figure I will. Yeah. So now shit's even worse, right? And I believe it's at that moment when the roommates spring on him why they're there, right? Or no?
No, it's the next sequence is the diaper sequence.
Yep.
When he comes back,
he gives in to his addiction.
So yeah.
And robs a convenience store.
So he robs a convenience store, which I want to point out. I don't even know how as a director, I mean, I might hazard a guess, but like wherever it came from, whether it was Nicolas Cage or it was the Coen brothers or some union of the two, the idea that every time a gun is fired at high, how he is slow to react and kind of just fine with it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't dodge bullets. He just slowly walks away and is unstartled by any gunshot that ever is thrown at him. And they get surprisingly close. And able to direct that to someone other than saying exactly what I said and having the other person absolutely go like, yeah, I totally know what you mean and I'm going to do that exactly. Because sometimes you think you're saying the right thing, but they don't know if you can't share a brain. But it's so perfect. It's such good touch to make it feel like both he's in danger and at the same time, this world obeys these silly rules that you just buy into.
Right.
You know, it's just Roadrunner.
And this is the beginning, by the way, of what's arguably the most famous sequence of this movie. Yet again, just like Blood Simple, a sequence that encompasses the midpoint. This is the midpoint of the film, which structurally, it works perfectly for the midpoint because this is when he makes a choice to plunge them back into a life of crime, which changes the entire world that they're in now. And just like the midpoint of Blood Simple, it's a long non-dialogue scene.
Oh, well,
there's a little more dialogue in this.
She talks to the baby.
You're right. That's what I just realized. But this is the famous long sequence to Carter Burwell's song Way Out There, which I said to Abe right before we started recording. The song Way Out There, the title track that you all know, that's like the cowboy yodel song from Raising Arizona. It's so good that I thought it was a real song from the 50s or 60s that they found. No, it's a Carter Burwell original designed to sound like those types of songs. And it's maybe my best it's my favorite classic 50s song.
Yeah.
It's maybe the most exciting piece of title score ever.
Yeah.
Such a good song.
Yeah,
Carter Burwell is a superstar in the Coen Brothers stable. Yeah,
he's a musical genius. He doesn't just do that. He also does everything else.
Right.
Like whatever genre you throw at him, he's like, I'll find you that. Oh, you want Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah,
Soggy Bottom Boys? You got it.
They brought in T-Bone Burnett to help out, but still.
That's true.
But he was just curating the actual tracks they would lift. So the important point is he's robbing the liquor store for diapers because they need diapers. And when Holly Hunter sees that that's what he's doing, she decides to ditch him there. Right. She decides to drive away, depriving him of a getaway car. So as soon as he sees her pulling out and he still has the gun on the guy. I love he goes, you better hurry up with that money. I'm in Dutch with the wife.
I'm in Dutch with the wife. Which I love that she says, you son of
you
a bitch,
of
over
a bitch.
And over in
you
front of the
son
baby.
Of a bitch.
Because earlier when we had the visitation from the brothers, Ed tells High not to cuss around Nathan.
Yeah.
Or no, this is right as they bring Nathan Jr. in. And he says, he don't know a cuss word from Shinola.
Yep.
And did you also read this fact?
Well, I always knew that phrase.
Oh, I didn't know that phrase.
It's an old expression. You don't know shit from Shinola?
Yeah, which in the South is Shinola's shoe polish. So it means...
You're dumb. You don't know shit from Shinola. Yeah, so he don't know a cuss word from Shinola. The dialects, they're the...
Which is a cuss word that isn't a cuss word.
They invent little turns of phrase that are so great. I love John Goodman. At one point, the baby's been left alone with them, and Nick Cage comes in, and he's like, where's the baby? Is he okay? And he goes, ah, don't worry about little Junior. He's in there sawing toothpicks.
So
like sawing logs, but little tiny baby logs.
Yes. Such little a good tiny little...
And I don't think that's a real expression. I think they made it up. It's so cute.
Yeah, I mean, like...
Could be a Southern expression.
I mean, yeah, like, I don't even know. I don't think anyone... It's so archaic that... That's the thing, is if it's invented, it's archaic enough always...
Yeah,
that you could believe it existed. Like, I felt the same with Oh Brother. Damn, we're in a tight spot. Those are all welcome words. Parts of the language, but never in that configuration have I ever heard as, like, a saying. Everything's got apostrophes in this script, by the way.
So there's an elaborate chase that can't really be described because it's just a badass chase sequence you have to watch. A bunch of funny stuff happens in it. The variety of shots they employ in their montages is also what makes it so refreshing to me. Like, you have cop style follow shots in this. You have tracking shots, jib shots, circular shots, everything.
I'm glad you picked up on that because that's just one thing. So something amazing about this sequence to me is that it's absolute action sequence tour de force. And I put it on the same level as Die Hard in the glass on the feet sequence and Hot Fuzz running out of the store chasing the guy and like the gaggle of goose. Yeah.
This is Edgar Wright's favorite movie, by the way.
What? Yes, that's right. Which is dope. That's right.
He's our other favorite director.
Yeah, and the reason is because I think Edgar Wright was probably taking this scene and because he noticed something when you watch it, and I wish I could just show the visual. Every sequence, every motion that's in front of camera, all the choreography, is either being introduced from side to side, and all directionality is front, is straight or going back. So everyone, shot of Holly Hunter and Nathan Jr., the shot of him running with the ski mask, the cops always inner frame from left or right. Everything, even the tracking shots when like High jumps over the gate, even though it's pivoting around because it's it loses him as he runs off and then it repans. So the camera dollies to a waist to make sure that he is absolutely in the center when he jumps off of the gate.
Right.
Even though that directionality of like that street and how they could get that shot, that isn't how you do that.
But it's storyboarding.
But they wanted it
like a comic book. The directionality means something. Yeah.
So in other words, there's only four motions. It's cardinal north, south, east, and west.
Yeah.
And that is all they play with in terms of motion in this entire every shot.
To make the geography super clear of this chase sequence, because it goes around several blocks.
Which is crazy because of what you said that made me even want to talk about this, is that it's just like the type of shots in their employ is so crazy because what it's doing is it's also not following directionality at all. Like they come from the left, they come from the right, we're on his back, we're dolling with him as he's running towards camera. Like that is not how you do geography in movies. If you want movies you go left to right or something like that.
I mean, compare it to, we talked about the last battle sequence in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
That's how you do clear geography in the traditional way, and it's brilliant.
You stay on the right side of the line.
Or you have a one-er that carries us to the next room so you see where we are.
Right, yeah. And so the geography is always clear because you always know he's in the middle of the street or he's hopping over trees. But you get the feeling that like when Holly Hunter's driving and she turns right around, you son of a bitch, and runs around, I gotta go pick up daddy.
She changes her mind, by the way, plot wise, and decides
feels
to
like
save
it's
him.
The same like street,
right?
Because they all look the same. It's all suburban, and you're completely disoriented. You don't know exactly like, is she close? Is she far away from him? Where are the cops in relation to him and her? Are they going to, all get caught? Where are the huggies dropped? You do not know. And they kind of dip into that and they go like, it's just random hysteria. That's
again,
all
it's
that
just,
we're doing.
It's
with
thought through so much that they know what you need to know and what you don't care to know. It
you
doesn't
don't care.
Matter.
You don't need to know.
Yeah. But as you alluded to, she does, it's one of those things where it's like, God damn it. And she turns around, decides to save him.
Yeah.
She picks him up in the car. They argue in the car. There's a couple great lines. he says, you know, but we don't have money. I did what I had to do for the family. And she goes, but we got a child now. Everything's changed. She says it like
that's
that.
So good. Yeah.
She kills it.
And then he goes, well, I'll tell you what. Nathan Jr. accepts me for what I am. And I think you better had too. You know, honey, it's, you know what it is? It's I'm okay and you're okay. And that there's what it is. Which again, they said like their ideas all come from supermarket magazines. And yeah. I'm like, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all sound by wisdom.
Okay, and you're okay. And that there is what it is, honey.
Yeah, it's all Chanel.
I love also, he's, this is in the earlier car sequence when he goes, what? Are you kidding me? We got a family here. Like, just so overjoyed that he has to question it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they do get home. They do lose the cops.
They do lose the cops.
Obviously, tension between the couples.
They get
at
the
an
huggies
because
that was important.
That's the little punchline of the scene as they drive back to grab the
and
huggies.
He picks it up. Yeah.
Wonk, wonk.
On the way home. And the next day, Glenn approaches High to fire him. And he's got a brace around his neck. And he says he's going to sue. And he also. Simultaneous, we haven't been chiming in as much because it's not as important. The idea of what's going on with the Arizonas. We haven't had the sequence where he's gotten to the point where he's going to invite a bounty hunter, but he's just having problems with police. And including that, there was an insert shot earlier, I think at the convenience store, of the fact that one of the Arizona's missing Nathan Jr. So Glenn
press
puts
release.
Two together.
And yeah. FYI, a thing we skipped over is we've seen Leonard Smalls in real life, so we know he's real at this point. But all we've seen him do is wordlessly go up to that gas station they stopped at to pomade their hair and smell the pomade. So we're like, okay, he can find people by smelling locations.
Because he's
we
a
know
wolf.
That, yeah.
He's covered in fur. Which
he says he's part hound dog.
Yeah, he's part hound dog. So it's that's all.
But back at the trailer park.
So Glenn has figured out that's Nathan Jr.
Oh, Glenn and Dot figured out they kidnapped the baby, yeah.
And Dot wants them. They're not going to turn in. They're going to turn them in and as a blackmail because she wants a new thing to cuddle, as he says, as he's driving away.
It's like a cat lady. When the babies get to be 4 years old, she just wants another baby.
Yeah, just wants another baby.
That's why
baby.
They have 8 babies. So they're saying, look, we can turn you in for the reward. There's a $25,000 reward, or we can forget all this if you give us that baby.
So he blackmails him, and then Gail and
Evel,
I think, overhear the conversation because they had to hide because High saw that. What does he say? You guys get.
Well, this
lost.
Is we. They had just a bunch of shit happens at once because it's a farce. They just told him something we need to know, which is. They have plans to rob a bank. That's why they came to him to crash versus anywhere else.
Right.
And as you said, John Goodman's like, I know you got a predilection and a pride in being a convenience store man, but we got ambitions high. And we're going to rob this bank, and it's just going to be the first leg of a spree across the country. Yeah. Like, they're obviously
dumb criminals.
They're going to
be bank
criminals.
Robbers for life, and we're going to be rich.
They're like, we aren't going to stop till we're rich. Yeah. And like they're like, we want you to come with us. And he's like, you guys got to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah,
then he steps outside and the Glenn exchange happens.
They overhear it.
And Glenn literally yells, I know you stole that baby. So they clearly overheard it because when High comes in, everything's immediately changed. They're holding the baby and they go, sorry about this, High. Like, they're obviously going to take the baby and turn it in
for
a reward.
They have their own plan. Yeah.
We want the 25
grand.
Throw
you under the bus. We're going to have that. Which then starts one of my favorite.
The best fight sequence of all time.
Oh, my God.
Which includes another fat man punching through a wall.
Yes. Goodman. No. He punches.
As in Blood Simple.
He punches through a cabinet door to withdraw a weapon. And all he gets is a wooden ruler. And he starts smacking High on the back with a wooden ruler.
And High's just. On his back the entire fight.
Yeah, basically. It's Andre the Giant Princess Bride kind of deal.
Yep.
And of course, everyone's favorite, when he tries to do a hammer blow with both fists and he raises it over his head and it the popcorn ceiling like rips up his hands.
And he goes, ah!
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a nice little touch. One of those kind of weird, like, it's just like, just a weird thing that happened in a fight. Just happened to happen.
Right, right. So they tie High up, they take the baby and the Dr. Spock book. You see their departure from Nick Cage's POV, which is very effective. And you know, it's that classic shot. He screams and it cuts to a wide shot of the prairie. So like, ah, oh, his soul is broken. This is the worst thing that could have happened.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Then what happens?
So Smalls visits Nathan, Arizona, talking, and they have there's a great line that's like, that would be $20,000 in 1954 money, meaning that it's like $100,000 that he could probably sell a baby on the black market.
Mm-hmm.
So $20,000 is not enough.
And right. He says, basically, I want more than the reward because I'm such a good tracker. I'm going to find your baby.
I'm going to find your baby.
So you pay me a lot more, or I'll just sell the baby to someone who will pay me for the baby.
Right.
Yeah.
And he calls him an evil man. He works him up to $5,000. So now the bounty on Nathan Jr.'s
is 25 now?
$50,000.
Oh, okay. He doubles it.
Yeah.
All right. So, and then John Goodman and his brother are driving down the road. He says, I figure between the ransom and this bank we're about to rob, you and I will be sitting in the fabled catbird seat.
I love that. It's also a Deadwood line that I love.
Yeah. So now there's this great, another just little cartoon bit, which is two no good, dumb criminals trying to take care of a baby.
Having big plans for themselves. So optimistic as all hell.
They stop at a store to get diapers and balloons.
Yeah.
And they rob the store.
Are these the ones that make you can turn into funny shapes? Unless circular is funny.
So he says, do these balloons blow up into funny shapes at all? If round is funny. And then in the car, he says, I also got balloons. And John Goodman goes, do they blow up into funny shapes at all? And he says, nah, just circular.
So it's just like they both care are brothers and they care about the same. Like they think something ingrained in their head is kids like funny shapes and balloons.
Yeah. Also a joke that's going to come back, so I want to mention it, is he tells the guy, this is his signature move. He tells the clerk, now lay down, close your eyes, and count to 895. And I'm going to come back in five minutes to check. Like you would come back to the crime scene. It's like, and I'll blow your head off if you're not still counting.
Yeah, like that's like how serious I am about you counting.
Right.
That's the important
So the old man starts counting and then halfway through is like, this is bullshit. And then because of unrelated circumstances, their car is driving back the other way.
Well, it's because they left the baby on the hood.
Right, yeah. So that's the next beat. You tell that.
But they forget that. Well, my favorite part about that is when they realize like, hey, where's Nathan Jr.? And then they look at each other and they both start screaming again. Comically, as if as they were birthed from the earth.
Yes, it's a callback to that scene. So they realize that they must have left the baby carrier on top of the car when they robbed the convenience store, so it slid off.
And
man, John Goodman is not just screaming, but hammering the ceiling of the car, hitting the dashboard, and showing us some shades of Walter from Lebowski.
Yeah,
he's like, you'd never leave a man behind. You'd never leave a man behind.
And of course, cut to just an insert shot of the baby where the baby's fine.
Which is the one cartoon thing I couldn't buy where I was like, it did topple. The implication is it did topple off the top of the car, and he just happened to land fine, I guess.
It's magic. It's all magic.
So they drive back to pick up the baby, almost hitting the baby in a shot that looks very scary to have gotten, but it was just reversed.
Yeah, they started, pressed the brakes, and then peeled out.
Peeled out backwards. And get the baby just as the old man is going, this is bullshit, and stops counting and sees them outside again. And it's like, oh, I guess they were telling the truth.
keeps counting. Picks up right where he left off.
Yeah.
Which is just a nice touch.
God, John Goodman, when he decides to stop punching the dashboard and start punching the ceiling of the car, is just gets me every time.
Right.
So, this event has plucked their heartstrings so much
that they now are the parents of the child.
Right. When they recover the baby, they immediately, because they're brothers and they're the same, he goes, we're never giving him up. And he goes, no, I don't care about that reward. He's our baby now.
I love the idea that Nathan Jr. is such a charismatic baby that whomever has ownership of that child, except for the mother and father, apparently, the true mother and father, immediately has decided that this is that they need to keep this baby.
Yeah.
They're not selling this baby.
So now the hunt is on. Everyone wants the baby. the bounty hunter, the parent, or, you know, our protagonist, the real parents, and these two criminals. We have four forces working towards acquiring the baby.
And the brothers go to rob a hayseed bank, which is a bank where farmers put in their paychecks every Friday, and bi-weekly, they take all the money out, and that's when they're going to hit the safe and presumably get hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right, a couple hundred grand.
But they really only have like a small duffel bag. Like, that's true. It's just a, like, what is it? The bag they're using satchel. Is a pillowcase.
Yeah. There's quick multi-cuts just to move the plot along. Ed comes home, unties High.
Yeah.
Tells him, you know, the last thing we're going to do together as a couple is do whatever it takes to recover that baby. Mm-hmm. Then after that, I want a divorce. Like, I just don't. We're obviously, not because I don't love you.
I just don't care anymore.
But because, look, we got together and we immediately became criminals again. Like, we're bad influences for each other.
Right. So they.
And
the robbery's so good.
Sorry, just to get you to the robbery real quick. Just everyone's on the case. Leonard Smalls also comes by the trailer,
right?
Just missing them.
Yeah.
Stares at the word fart, which is a great shot
sequence.
Which
is just a great insert, just like this very serious man, just wind out of sails with, he had to look at a single written word, and the word was fart.
And then he sees the newspaper article about the bank that they are casing, and he's just an amazing tracker. So he's after them. Everyone's zeroing in on them.
Right.
While they rob the bank, describe the bank robbery, Abraham.
Oh my God. So first off, my favorite part is that when Evel says Gail's name, he says Gail in front of everybody after having this long dialogue about whether or not they should freeze or get down. And then they finally decide you should all get down. And then they get scared because when they look behind the bank, all the tellers are on the ground.
Invisible.
And they're like, where'd they go?
Where'd the tellers go? We're down here. They got down when you told them to, Sonny. freeze, get down on the ground. Now I can't rightly get down on the ground if I'm frozen and I shut up. Just get down on the ground. Then freeze.
All right. So my favorite, perhaps my favorite bit with these two is after everyone's clearly heard.
Important point. They don't want to leave the baby in the hot car.
So they bring the baby.
He's carrying the baby.
He's carrying the baby during a robbery. Yeah. But so after he said his name, they then try to convince everybody that they were using code names and Gail is his code name, which is just such a perfect, like, it's the kind of thing where you see them make a mistake, have an idea, and follow through it in the most stupid way.
I told you not to say names, not even code names.
Code names?
Right. Because Gail is my code name.
It's just one of the most delightful little pieces of logic.
Yeah.
I love it. My favorite thing about comedy characters, and I had a huge debate with people at film school about this. They're like, just get them to do the thing. Just tell them what their want is and go to town. And I'm like, no, because when Job in that scene in Arrested Development mishears beads with bees, there had to be a conversation, even if it was just, you know, Will Arnett in his head, but he had to think of, like, all right, what's the logic of Job? Job is thinking that at this moment he heard bees. Now he's thinking about bees and bzzz. And now he's thinking of these puns. It's like, it's a very slow, easy to follow logic. And the fact that they both, like, since they are one human, they like get this back and forth dialogue of stupidity just makes that moment for me. It's just such a fucking well-crafted joke.
We'll see who earns more honey. So he does his signature move.
Yep.
Stay on the ground for 10 minutes. We'll be back in 5 to check. And John Goodman says another line. I just love the turn of phrase. Anyone found bipedal in 5 wears his ass for a hat.
Bipedal.
And they, of course, they're so fucking stupid. They leave the baby again.
They leave the baby in the bank. And the only thing that we haven't mentioned is at one point the teller who's packing up all the money as they leave happens to put a timed dye canister in so it'll explode and make them blue paint.
And indeed it does explode, blinding them. They scream again.
Try to wipe
off the windshield just as they get their view back. They can see that they're about to slam into High and Ed in their car, who are racing towards the bank. Mm-hmm. Do they actually crash, or do the cars just stop and they engage with each other? I don't remember.
They don't crash. They swerve and,
okay.
and he brakes.
They swerve.
And then they run out of the car.
Ed and High both come at them with guns and put guns in their faces and go, "Where's the goddamn baby?" And they go, "We were just going to get him. We're sorry.
Yeah.
We left him. We love him now. We don't want harm to come to him."
Exactly.
Which I love this because they stole their baby, and yet Nick Cage at the end is like, "They're not bad guys."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They did just love Nathan Jr.
Up to shenanigans.
Yeah, they're just outlaws. You can see that in them. So they go, the baby's back at the bank. Here's the Dr. Spock book, which is the last Dr. Spock
but
beat.
Smalls arrives before they get back to
Jr.
So
it's the final standoff at the bank between Smalls and High and Ed. Basically, the brothers, the Snotes have now been dispatched as a final boss. They're not in the movie again until we get their wrap up in the prologue. So now it's time to face off against the movie's actual villain. What's his name? Leonard Smalls. Yeah.
Or the biker of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Ed grabs the baby and flees. High tries to fight Smalls, but Smalls is a Frankenstein's monster of strength.
Yeah. Nick Cage is doing the classic thing that a plucky, weak hero can do, which is just let the shit get beat out of him and try and hang in there.
Yeah.
He lets himself get dragged by the bike across gravel and
right.
stuff.
And
he's really losing.
Smalls is excellent at knives. He's a knife thrower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Holly, however, does the supermom thing where she just like rips off her hat and tie or like clip or whatever she's wearing and marches directly at the scary man, not caring that he has two shotguns out, going, "Give me that baby.
Give me that
you
baby.
Give me my baby. Give me that
and
baby."
Smalls just kind of lets it happen.
Well, no. He's going to shoot her or throw a knife at her, one or the other. And
right.
Nick Cage is able to shoot him through the hand.
Yeah.
Which also creates fire because, like, I guess his blood is fire.
Yeah,
the hell
so.
Biker.
Yeah.
A bullet goes through his hand and flames come out of the hole.
Right.
But regardless, that buys them a second. He ends up like tackling Nick Cage. They have a scuffle.
Yeah,
it's
the ending
of The Professional. He tosses Nick Cage away, which gives him enough time to recover his guns, cock them, point them at Nick Cage, and then Nick Cage holds up his hand, revealing he has a grenade pin. And you see that he pulled a pin.
I noticed that the fight had a lot of...
I like that Nick Cage says, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry," and then the guy explodes.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting that the fight scene had a lot of, like, this fight scene had a lot of, maybe it's just because one of the fighters is consistent high, but it had a lot to do with the same, I wonder if it was intentional to make the brothers, like, big and husky, kind of like Smalls, because it's, like, the same basic choreography of the fight when they're, like, grappling each other.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Yeah, different bits, though.
Like different bits.
The jokes,
I mean,
quote
yeah,
unquote. That
but I mean, it's the
fight.
Same kind of thing where.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, once the board gets introduced, because Holly Hunter knocks him out
with a board.
With
yeah.
a board, which gets High the time to, you know, like grab another board and block.
Yeah. You
knives.
Know how action sequences go.
Yeah,
the last second, they barely save each other from the rampaging
right.
monster. Yeah.
I just thought it was a nice little touch. The grappling being like, it's almost like fighting with John Goodman prepared him for Smalls or something like that.
Sure.
I don't know. But yeah, so Smalls explodes and
we're into the resolution of the
film. Resolution, which starts with the big scene of returning Arizona back to his
they decide to
crib,
voluntarily return him. Yeah.
Which of course Nathan Senior kind of is there and notices that they're there. And
he catches them with a giant,
yeah.
I just got to point out, with a giant Desert Eagle or
yeah.
Colt revolver with like a six-inch barrel or
gun.
Something. And during that scene, when he is investigating the crib and doing business with Nathan Jr.,
he's
points the
gun.
Revolver directly at his son several times.
Yeah.
And there's even a shot where in the corner of the frame, he has set the gun down in the crib and is several feet away looking at and talking to Nick Cage and Holly Hunter
yeah.
and the baby's crawling around towards the gun.
Yeah.
It's like you could add a gunshot sound effect off frame and ruin
yeah,
the movie.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God. And but at this point, High and Ed are like as low as they can be. Even though they've saved Nathan Jr. from death, they don't think that they're good parents. They inspire, as Holly Hunter says, inspire the worst parts of each other.
They don't think they're good enough to for each other.
Yeah. And so how are they going to bring it, how are they going to do any good to buy this child? So while returning it, Nathan Sr. asks why they did it, and they're just like, we're going to break up, and like, this is why we did it.
Yeah, we can't conceive. Yeah.
And I kind of thought it was like a nice little touch at the start of like, we're the ones who found him, is what High says to Nathan Sr., saying like almost as if he's just kind of doubling back to his old ways, where he's going to not blackmail, but try to get that reward money. Yeah. But then within like maybe 10 lines of dialogue, once Nathan Sr. is like, you were the one, he's just immediately like,
yeah, you're right. Because, we don't need the money. Yeah.
In other words, like he's flirting with it because it's what he knows. It's his nature. But this situation has changed him so much, and they love Nathan Jr. so much that he will be honest with the man.
Yeah. And then he convinces them. He says, don't break up tonight. Just sleep on it. You seem like a nice couple.
Never go to bed angry.
And he says, yeah, it would be like me breaking up with Florence. I love her so much. And it's actually so funny because the actor in that moment is so real and heartfelt. You're like, oh, that's a long marriage. He's very passionate for that woman. The only lines she's ever said in the movie are, yes, dear, and no dear, and stuff like
that's
that.
That's their love.
And I love that he finally reveals that, like, behind closed doors in his heart, he's like, I love her so much.
Yeah. Plus, there's kind of a hinting that they had their own fertility problems.
He says, yeah, the problem is we use too much fertility medication. That's why we had 5. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so
he says,
they have a shared
worry,
bond.
Medical science could catch up with you. You guys should stick together and keep trying. Who knows? You just talk to one doctor. So they do. They sleep on it. Nick Cage has a dream, which is also one of the more famous sequences of the movie, parodied a lot in other things.
Right.
The dream with the closing narration of him dreaming, what do you think? Either stuff that is going to happen.
Or is it a fantasy, or is it what actually happened? Well,
either way, they're going to stay together.
This kind of, let's slide this into their next sequence, because I think this is how the movie ends, is kind of tells us how, it kind of is everything. It's about like, what's the situation of the movie and what are you supposed to determine is real and what is a fantasy? What's a folktale?
All right. And this spectrum is known as pedagogy. We're moving into pedagogy, which is where we talk about what did the movie mean? What were the themes,
etc.? So my take, at least to answer that question, my take is
continuing with the dream question.
I think that obviously it's got to be a mix of both, but here's the compelling reason why to me. The only other real dream that we've seen High have in the past has truths mixed with falses. It is prophecy. It's he misreads the interpretation of what's actually going to happen. He thinks he's a biker from the apocalypse and he's pure evil. Smalls is pretty evil, but he's not like descended
magic
from hell.
Right.
There are magic elements of him, but he himself is not as magic as he is in that dream.
Also in the dream, he implies that he assumes that he's just imagining this thing because he's so stressed and his brain is literalizing his troubles.
So,
but no, the guy literally exists.
So here's what
out.
I think. So I think that how we're supposed to take the ending, which, what does that even mean? But like, how I take it, I guess, is that High is kind of a prophet in this regard. His dreams do have merit, and the details especially are kind of true almost all the time. Like, he got the fucking tattoo down. So I think that he is unable to see the reality truly, but his interpretation of real events is completely wrong.
Right.
But he actually is seeing the future. In other words, I think what we're supposed to take the end is
analogous will happen.
He's going, they're going to have children. They're going to be happy, but like, maybe it isn't 800 kids, you know, maybe it isn't, but it's like a nice little dream. It's the new salad days.
Right. He premonishes a return to the salad days, as they say.
Exactly.
And for people who need a refresher, the ending is his dream that night. He dreams basically an ending for everyone. Oh, real quick, just because you mentioned the tattoo, I also wanted to make sure to mention that is some defunct like gasoline or racing motor company logo. whatever, who cares?
All right.
But it's a tattoo of a woodpecker with his hair blown back, smoking a cigar. And the reason they went with that motif for Nick Cage's character is there's just a thing where his hair gets higher and higher.
As he gets more stressed?
The more stress he has in his scene, and when like things are calm again, his hair can calm down. Like Woody Woodpecker. And I think the most interesting aspect is during the fight with Leonard Smalls, he reveals that Leonard Smalls has an identical tattoo. And I think that that's just to show that, like, Leonard Smalls actually is a bad criminal, a fully corrupt criminal.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're not so different, you and I, but without having to have anyone say that. He's got the tattoo, you've got the tattoo. This is the end result of a criminal who has gone all the way down the dark side.
Right, right. And I actually think it was an interesting notion, going back to, because we've mentioned like Looney Tunes and this idea of...
Yeah.
I don't think originally, if I had to hazard a guess, they thought Woody Woodpecker. They've said it in interviews several times that... But Woody Woodpecker has like the same hair as Roadrunner. Mm-hmm. And Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote are obviously like down to the Chuck Jones, like it's the American Southwest.
Right.
It's comically violent. One of them is literally a wolf in the cartoon. This guy looks like a wolf and was raised mm-hmm. by hounds or whatever, is part hound.
Oh, right.
And so
Smalls is the wolf and High is the Roadrunner, for sure.
And he's literally running down roads most of the movie.
Right.
So I think they did the Woody Woodpecker nod because they thought it would be too on the nose to make him literally Roadrunner.
And again, it's not officially Woody Woodpecker. That is the logo of like a motorsports company that went out of fashion, but the logo stayed popular.
Right, right. Okay. But yeah, I just think it's one of those things because they've said in interviews how it's
the hair thing for sure. Yeah. So, but as for back to the dream, what it actually is, he says, he basically ends everything. He imagines that the brothers, the Snoats, will voluntarily walk back to the prison covered in blue paint, go into the poo hole and crawl back through the sewer and put themselves in jail. And he said like, just because they're not ready for the big, great world yet.
Weren't ready yet to come out into the world.
Yeah. And then he says, and as for me and Ed, we can be good too. But it seemed real. It seemed like us. And it seemed like, well, home. And he's dreaming way of the future, them as old people. If not Arizona, then a land not too far away, where all parents are wise and capable, and all children are beloved. I don't know. Maybe it was Utah. And in the shots, you see that they have tons of kids and grandkids. So somehow they overcame the infertility issue and they're just like old people holding hands.
Yeah.
Final shot of the movie. I also have this question. Why not end in the dream? Because the final shot of the movie is Nick Cage's eyes open, waking up from the dream. Then it cuts to credits.
I think that's the sign of agency. Because you can have a dream and wake up and forget it. The way in which his eyes open means that he's learned to take these dreams seriously, and he's going to be proactive in making sure that he and Holly Hunter follow what Nathan Sr. was saying and try and try again. That's my interpretation.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. That's not very nihilist. That's my main question to bring up in the pedagogy.
It's their least nihilistic film.
I think
even Lady Killers.
But dude, in Hudsucker, a guy who is good at heart, but circumstances conspire to make him jump off the roof of a building. An angel stops time to save him because he's a good guy. That is as opposite of nihilistic, I think, as you can get.
I disagree, even though I understand what you're saying about like the imagery and such. But I think that's like...
The imagery is literally the universe intervening because guy.
I know. It's literally an angel.
Yeah.
Here's the reason why is that Hudsucker, I believe, works on this poetic justice that this film also does, which, as we mentioned in our Blood Simple, they're like the odd two out mm-hmm. because they're usually nihilistic filmmakers. And what we said last time, and if you didn't listen to Blood Simple, nihilistic in the sense of they don't give any credence to the idea that there is like providence. It's all
karma or justice.
It's just a bunch of atoms bumping into each other. And all right, with that said, I think that Hudsucker is much less because your guy is a good guy. Like Tim Robbins is so good, and the world, and that he's been like in this capitalistic wasteland that he's been introduced.
I cannot wait to get to Hudsucker. Like my favorite movie of all time.
Good. Because he gets what he earned. But he already started as a good guy. This movie, he starts in the gutter. He's literally incarcerated like 20
repeatedly,
times.
Yeah.
And he gets to have a great life. So it's like, if Tim Robbins, in other words, came and he comes from Indiana, you know, like he's go Eagles and all that stuff. Like,
Muncie.
He's not a bad guy. He started off as a good guy. And in this world...
No, it's the opposite plot. He becomes an asshole as he gets power, and then he has to relearn how to be a good guy again. Yeah.
And but in Raising Arizona, it's just a constant. He gets better.
That's true. He starts as the worst guy he's ever going to be in the movie.
So to me, that's what makes this movie the least nihilistic film, because it's absolutely just a hero's journey. It's just a hero's journey.
And the ending really gets me. I always tear up, and it does feel like everything's okay. There is always hope. And I'm like, that's so not Cohen to leave the movie feeling that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause Hudsucker, he has his like in the, who has a lower point? Tim Robbins or Nick Cage? Nick Cage has the world acting upon him in a sad way.
Absolutely, Tim Robbins. Tim Robbins literally brings it upon himself. Doesn't just consider, but makes the choice to kill himself.
Yep.
He doesn't know he'll be saved. So
exactly.
It was as dark as you can be. He wanted to not live anymore.
And I mean, I guess that's because it's not really Nick Cage, even though
but that's another story.
We see through Ahai's eyes, but like Ed is also the main character.
Yes,
too.
Absolutely.
And she has her lowest point.
Right.
And she might kill herself, but
do you think there's a theme to the movie or a resonant line or a summation line? Because I found one I think could be it.
You go first.
But it also might not need one. The theme might be it's a fun cartoon. Sometimes this is a hard world for little things. That's all. Like, I think because it's obviously on the theme of raising a child. And I wonder if the message of this film is as simple as that, is like, yeah, when your first kid is born, or however you acquire your first kid. And I've talked about this on Tales from the Pit with Soren and Griffin. You experience a kind of joy and a kind of fear you've never experienced before. Like Griffin's so terrified of somehow killing the tiny baby before it gets big enough to not easily be killed. And he's like, it really is a staggering fear. And I wonder if it's just about that. Like, here's a guy who is compelled to be a criminal, and he wants to be good, and he as he becomes legit or whatever and gets the things that like a good standard member of society wants, he realizes he vastly underestimated the level of responsibility. It's crazy and it's overwhelming.
Biology and the prejudices of others conspire to keep us childless.
Yep. Yeah, because they wouldn't adopt to him because he had a record.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's all I got. It's not like pedagogy is going to be light on this, because this is mostly about how fun were all those lines and all those things that happened.
Yeah, it's a lot of people criticized it as having style over substance, right?
Yes, but like by that measure, I just like to approach things on their own terms.
Yeah, it's a popcorn movie. It's judge it on those terms.
Arrested Development, their actual shtick that they are going for is to be as shallow, hollow, vapid, and substanceless as possible. And I love that show. So that proves that you don't have to be Freaks and Geeks. There doesn't have to be heart. Something can be devoid of soul if the goal is just, look how amazing this cartoon is. It's so funny. You know what I mean? And I think that's what you got here.
Yeah.
Want to do Howdy Doodat?
Sure.
Howdy Doodat!
Howdy Doodat.
This is trivia, fun facts, and behind-the-scenes info. What do you got?
Let me pull up my little thing here.
Please don't. I don't want to see your little thing. Don't pull it up.
Oh, no!
Okay, I'll say one then. Nathan Jr. doesn't cry in the whole movie.
The kid?
But every other character...
The baby actor?
Yes, never cries, but every other adult cries in his presence. It's just like
he's got this crazy charisma that causes people to cry.
It's also just like the gun in Blood Simple, or the detective in Blood Simple, where it's like, you know, they never see him.
Does Nathan Sr. cry in front of Nathan Jr.? Or is he not?
I think it's
character?
Referring to just, yeah, hi, the brothers. Two brothers and Ed.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a shot when Florence, Arizona is discovering that Nathan Jr. is gone.
Oh, yeah.
And also, Hi's dream of the biker of the apocalypse shows the biker's POV approaching the Arizona residence. Both of those shots were a rig that is as simplistic as it gets. It's when you have no money and you want to make like a steady cam and movement. And it was invented by and called Raimi board.
Mm-hmm.
So it was used in The Evil Dead when the possessed spirit, it's the one that, so they speed it up. That's why it has that unique look, but it's like when it's trying to navigate, when the possessed spirit is running, like through the forest or like, when they dolly into Bruce Campbell's face, it kind of has that weird, like,
low to the ground, fast moving.
Uh-huh. And it's just a camera taped to a plywood plank that has two guys running.
One on either side running, holding it low to the ground.
Yeah. And they used it in both those places here. So here's where the Coen brothers saw, oh shit, that's a cool thing, Raimi. We're going to use it in this one because it has this weird look.
Yeah.
Also, Raimi also is one of those guys who is kind of mixes that idea of like, this is really campy horror. Like I'm making a seriously horrifying movie
with funny
but it's
parts,
funny.
Right.
So they're doing the same thing, I think, here where they're trying to tell this, like they're trying to, in one case, trying to tell a horrible thing happening to a mother losing a child, but by kidnapping. And then two, a biker of the apocalypse, which might as well just be the Evil Dead, you know?
Yeah, and I love how they, I think, felt the need to top Raimi. They're like, well, if we're going to steal this, we got to add an element. Their Raimi board shot doesn't just approach the house, it goes up the ladder and into the window. So they made it more challenging for themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the boards got better, you know, like good
quality boards. I was talking about how I love the variety of shots in the montages, and one that really got me is how it's going directional left to right, directional left to right, directional left to right, and then all of a sudden they pause to do a that 70s show circle shot pointing out from the center, like a Lazy Susan shot of the support group, which A, just shows you like a murderer's row of interesting looking faces that's clearly like this is what they like to cast, and B, I read online the guy leading the group has a necklace that's a Jewish symbol, and it's a symbol that's pronounced
Chai.
It's spelled C-H-A-I, but it's pronounced Hi. So it's just a reference to H.I. McDonough. Yeah.
That's stupid, but cool.
It's pointless. It's pointless. they have also said in interviews that they came up with Leonard Smalls when they decided not to envision a villain for this film that they think is realistic or something that appeals to them, but try to imagine the kind of villain Nicolas Cage's character would imagine in a movie he were writing. It's almost got an adaptation feel to it.
Yeah, that's
so like he's
Charlie Kaufman-esque.
But it lends credence to the fact that so like Leonard Smalls is born from his dreams.
Yeah,
this might be the story of a guy whose dreams magically come real.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Before I Wake, that movie that just came out. Yeah.
Where he just manifests his reality just by dreaming them.
Yeah.
So he's not a prophet, but he's a god?
Exactly, yeah. let's see. OPE and POE are both spray painted on the door of the gas station restroom.
Poe and OPE, what's OPE?
It's references to Dr. Strangelove, one of their favorite movies. OPE is the nuclear recall code, and General Ripper in Strangelove is obsessed with POE because it means purity of essence in his mind.
Oh, yeah.
I got to watch that again, though.
I got to watch Strangelove. I didn't even catch
that
reference.
We'll frame rate it.
Yeah.
Only other thing I unearthed that I thought was interesting is the lullaby Ed sings to Nathan Jr. is an actual old lullaby.
Isn't it about like murdering people?
And we don't hear the lyrics, but the actual lyrics are about a guy brutally murdering his fiance and hiding the body. Yeah.
Someone was telling me that. Which is just, no one would ever pick up on that. Like they just like the tune.
They just picked it, yeah.
It doesn't have anything to do with anything. There's no intention there.
Joel directed, Ethan produced. Is that the opposite of Blood Simple or the same?
Joel directs, Ethan produces.
Always? Oh, okay.
Almost always. I think there's a few films that they co-directed. I don't know why.
They're not editing themselves yet because there's no Roderick James. It's Mike R. Miller for this one.
Yeah.
Still got Carter Burwell. Still got Barry Sonnenfeld.
Wait, is Roderick Janes? I thought this was edited by Roderick Janes. And
in the credits, it says Michael R. Miller. I checked.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, so Roderick, so everyone knows Roderick Janes is a kind of nom de plume for their editorial collaboration. So Ethan and Joel tandem edit, and they often don't
They don't want the
an
credits
editor.
To say edited by Ethan and Joel.
No, that's not reason why. They created it because the editors union got angry at them.
That's what I was about to say.
Oh,
that
okay.
is why.
So it had an intention. It was just right. them like saying, fuck the situation, like fuck the system. We're going to be the ones who, there's this new guy, his name's Roderick Janes.
Because there's rules about how many credits you can include. They don't want you to do every job yourself because they want you to employ more union people. And on the one hand, that's great. On the other hand, it's their movie, and if they are directors and they're also incredibly skilled editors and they want to edit it, they should get to.
Yeah, yeah, I think they should. We should allow those guys to do whatever they
yes.
want. They edit their own work very well, which is a unique art. Most people need editing, you know, even the most talented of us. And these guys, I never find like I'm, like they're overstaying their welcome or anything. This movie is like a pretty tight, like 94 minutes.
Yeah, Blood Simple was also almost exactly 90. They're keeping it real short to start out with.
That's also smart.
But don't get used to it, because next up is Miller's Crossing, which is epically long, I believe.
Yeah, it's over 2 hours.
Yeah, I think 2 hours, 11 minutes or something. That could be inaccurate because we haven't done our research yet. But we will be back next time with Miller's Crossing on the Coen Brothers Brothers.
We're good singers. Maybe we should start a band.
Yates Sands. Yates Sands.
This has been a Small Beans endeavor. We're a bunch of pals who make podcasts, sketches, music, web series, and movies. The Beans always have new ideas percolating, so make sure to check us out at patreon.com/smallbeans. That's patreon.com/smallbeans, where you can browse all of our current and past content, see what we've got planned in the future, and learn how your support can help the Small Beans grow into huge, giant monster beans. If you enjoyed this content module, please like, rate, subscribe, or tell a friend about us. We love you!